Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, a new communications law in Ecuador seeks to break up powerful media conglomerates, create new community and public media, and promote diversity on the airwaves. To U.S. critics, though, it's really a way for left-leaning President Rafael Correa to silence his critics. Rafael Correa will join us to talk about the law and the press in his country. Also on Counterspin today, at the first anniversary of the Rana Plaza garment factory collapse in Bangladesh, a new film challenges U.S. corporations' accountability for workplace conditions at suppliers that they always seem to claim not to know. Made in Bangladesh from Al Jazeera America's Fault Line series recently won a Peabody Award. We'll speak with its producer, author and journalist Leila Alarian of Al Jazeera English. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
News reports out of Yemen on April 19th suggested a major round of attacks were underway, some involving U.S. drones. In such situations, one can always count on someone to appear on TV to say that such weapons don't kill innocents. CNN was on that case right away, getting former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Christopher Hill on to say this, quote, "I have seen a number of these strikes, and it is amazing how accurate and how well targeted they are. I mean, the idea that innocents are being killed, it's really not the case," close quote. But the first reports out of Yemen from the government had already admitted that three civilians had been killed in the first strike. Those deaths were explained by CNN Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr with this, quote, "It looks like three civilians were killed, and that is always a big problem for the United States, because the government of Yemen is very sensitive to these drone strikes," close quote. The difficulty of reporting anything from Yemen meant that stories relied mostly on government sources, either U.S. or Yemeni, which is never a good way to establish the facts. On April 22nd, the New York Times presented its take under the all-too-appropriate headline, "U.S. Drones and Yemeni Forces Kill Qaeda-Linked Fighters," officials say. The Times has a history of taking the official word. Last December, a drone strike on a wedding convoy was portrayed in the paper as likely being a hit on al-Qaeda militants. It's still not clear who was targeted this time or why, but unfortunately, media seem once again too willing to take the government's word.
NBC's Meet the Press has made a habit of complaining that world leaders don't always seem to do what Barack Obama tells them to. They reprised that lament on April 20th, but managed to make it more offensive. Right-leaning pundit David Brooks was on hand, and he offered this pearl of wisdom.
They said Obama, whether deservedly or not, does have a, I'll say it crudely, but a manhood problem in the Middle East. Is he tough enough to stand up to somebody like Assad, somebody like Putin? I think a lot of the rap is unfair, but certainly in the Middle East, there's an assumption he's not tough.
Besides suggesting that I'll say it crudely might join I'm not a racist but as the point in conversation at which a speaker might consider stopping, there's a serious point to be made about the implicit message being conveyed here and elsewhere that Obama either doesn't use or threaten to use military force often enough. Obama's record should speak for itself. A massive surge of U.S. troops in Afghanistan to escalate that war, NATO airstrikes in Libya, and continued drone attacks in several countries. In fact, one of the main foreign policy stories the morning of Brooks' comments were a series of attacks in Yemen that seemed to be U.S. drone attacks. But so ingrained among elites is the idea that Obama isn't tough enough that the only response on Meet the Press was NBC reporter Chuck Todd saying something about how Obama needs to be more alpha dog. While such terms might sound silly, that they confront no dissenting view is anything but funny.
One of the most frequent claims about what is happening in Ukraine is that the Russian government is more involved than it admits. To some observers, the armed men operating in parts of eastern Ukraine look a lot like Russian special forces units, there to stir up unrest. The New York Times seemed to finally nail that story down in a big front-page scoop on April 20th, at least until they quietly walked the story back a few days later. The piece relied on photographic evidence gathered by Ukrainian officials and shared with the U.S. government, which then shared it with the New York Times. The photos seemed to show armed men in Russia who were also photographed in Ukraine. The photos, the Times oddly noted, had been endorsed by the Obama administration. Then came the April 23rd edition of the paper, and the headline, "Scrutiny Over Photos Said to Tie Russia Units to Ukraine." It turns out that some people aren't sure that one guy who appears in photos from both countries is actually the same person. And what was perhaps the strongest piece of evidence, photos showing a group of what appear to be special forces in Russia and then also in Ukraine, that washed out entirely, since the photographer explained that both images were in fact taken in Ukraine. The Times isn't exactly correcting its reporting. As the paper puts it, the dispute over the group photographed cast a cloud over one particularly vivid and highly publicized piece of evidence. Well, yeah, publicized by your newspaper. Some reporters were skeptical of the photographs right away. One ABC correspondent tweeted that he had met the group of men in the photo and that they weren't Russian forces. The best response may have been from veteran journalist Robert Perry, who wrote this: "In the old days of journalism, we used to apply the scrutiny before we published a story on the front page."
Though ostensibly free of monarchy for more than two centuries, as Slate pointed out, American media sure seemed fascinated by news of Chelsea Clinton's pregnancy, as if indeed the child would represent an heir to a dynasty. That fascination has led to some painfully odd punditry, largely focused on what role a child might play in the electoral prospects of Hillary Clinton. Discussion that is warranted, The Washington Post's Kathleen Parker helpfully explained, because while Clinton has not announced her candidacy, she is, quote, "running in the American mind, if not in fact," close quote. So, the New York Times ponders how the public will view a commander-in-chief who bounces a toddler one day and orders drone strikes the next, while Bloomberg columnist Margaret Carlson suggests bizarrely that, according to the joke, that women age in dog years, quote, "no male candidate will ever be as old as Clinton is now at 462, close quote. And there was this from Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank, appearing on NBC Nightly News.
"Nobody assumes this was done for political reasons, of course, but if it had been done for political reasons, it could not have been at a better time. Hillary Clinton will have this bouncing toddler in her arms to campaign with in 2016.
That's quite a message to women political candidates. It will be considered necessary to actively disregard the idea that you may have arranged for your adult daughter to become pregnant so as to provide you a political prop. We've come a long way.
And finally, we're saddened to learn of the death of journalist Robert Knight. Knight worked for more than three decades at New York Pacifica affiliate WBAI, where he was a reporter and anchor on programs including 5 O'Clock Shadow, Earth Watch, and the daily morning show Undercurrents. He was WBAI's senior national correspondent until August 2013, when the entire WBAI news department was laid off over Pacifica's dire financial situation. Knight's reporting took him many places, including Nicaragua, Colombia, North and South Korea, and Libya. He won the prestigious Polk Award in 1989 for his interview with Panamanian President Manuel Noriega and investigation into the U.S. invasion of Panama. Knight also reported for Comedy Central's Daily Show, NPR, and Free Speech Radio News. FAIR owes Knight a special gratitude. We got our start in radio at WBAI in 1988, when Knight and Undercurrents co-host Dennis Bernstein turned over their Friday morning slot to us. That show, FAIR Undercurrents, was the precursor to Counterspin. Robert Knight will be missed.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
It's not often that press regulation in another country becomes an issue for U.S. media. Politics, of course, play a major factor. That might explain so much of the criticism of a new communications law promoted by left-leaning President Rafael Correa of Ecuador. The law aims to break up the major commercial owners, establish public and community media, and promote diversity on the public airwaves. But critics point to provisions intended to protect against media attacks, the so-called anti-lynching regulations, as a way for the government to silence dissent. Correa was in New York City recently, so we sat down to talk about why the law came into being and how the fight is really all about political power.
It's been intensely criticized in the United States. People say it's a vehicle for neutralizing your critics, attacking the press. When I was in Ecuador and I talked to people who were proponents of the law, they said, in America, you don't understand how the media in Ecuador work. What is unusual or, I guess, political about the Ecuadorian media that I think created the environment for this communication law?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for this interview. Secondly, I think communication law like the Ecuadorian one will be great even in the United States, because it's not a law just for the media. It's a communication law, something very important for society, communication. Well, the best way to answer your question about the media situation in Ecuador, you can come to visit us to read every day in the newspapers critics toward the government, toward the president. So there is absolutely free press in Ecuador, but now with the new law, they have to be responsible about what they published, what they said, etc. And well, in this sense, the law is very important, because it gives to people rights in order to defend themselves from some abuses of the media. What is the difference between Ecuadorian media with American media? I have lived in the States. I have lived in Europe. Well, here you also can find abuses from the media, but at least you have ethic, you have professionalism. In Ecuador, you have nothing. There is a monopoly owned by the elite that always has controlled our countries. They are the opposition, illegitimate opposition to the government. So, the quality of the media is absolutely different from the quality of the media in the United States, in Europe.
Reading the law, I was struck by seeing provisions about diversity on the airwaves, listening to people talk about the disabled, the young, the old. Everyone should be represented in the communications of the country. Well, I think one of the things that is so striking is media activists in this country for 20 years have said, we want to challenge the power of the people who dominate the media. In Ecuador, the proposal is now to break up the power of the media elites and create new outlets altogether?
Of course, you're absolutely right, and that is the other problem. That is the reason why media owners are against the government. For instance, when I arrived to the government, 6 out of 7 or 8 national TV channels were owned by bankers. If I wanted to regulate the banking system, I had a propaganda very manipulating the truth, manipulating the regulation, etc. So it's not sane for a society to have this conflict of interest, to have economic power, finance power, together to media power. In our new constitution from 2008, we prohibit this. But that means to break the spine of the power structure in Ecuador. So they are losing their power. Development is basically a political process. Why our countries are underdeveloped? Because we are always being controlled by some little elites. And in this way, we are breaking this structure of power. So they are very furious against us. But, for this reason, every day we receive attacks from this media. society must overcome these power groups and to think about common good. For this reason, Ecuadorian society decides to do this communication law in order to regulate the media.
When I was in Ecuador, I talked to people about public radio. I talked to journalists, I talked to cab drivers, and they said, no, this is brand new. We didn't have public radio. We didn't have public television until a few years ago. This is a revolution in how people look at this. But the critics say, well, there is this language in the law about criticizing the government. They call it the lynching law or the anti-lynching provision.
Just a precision. It's not about the government, it's about any citizen.
Mm-hmm. Is that a threat to freedom of the press? How do you balance protecting individuals with allowing journalists to report?
I agree. This is a difficult issue. For this reason, you have to be very careful, because if you protect too much rights of the people, perhaps you are impeding free press. But if you don't have any regulation, people's life can be destroyed because of the abuse of the media. So we try to find the balance, the right balance. We are not imposing a priori. You should say this, you cannot say that. No, you have to treat the information with responsibility, and you should be careful not to destroy people's life. That means linchamiento mediático.
Media lynching.
We have had several cases like this, because the owner of a newspaper hated someone. Every day, bad news about this person, slander, libel, lies, etc. So this is media lynch. So the new law protect people from this kind of abuse.
In the media in this country, I want to tell you, you've been called, in the Time magazine, a fervent anti-Yankee nationalist. In the Washington Post,
this is new.
A small-time...
You say again?
A fervent anti-Yankee nationalist.
Fervent anti-Yankee nationalist. Oh, wonderful.
In the Washington Post, they called you a small-time South American autocrat. I get the feeling that the anger about the communications law is not about press freedom, it is about politics. Do you think that's part of it?
Of course, that is very clear. You should be very aware that our political opposition is not the political parties. They are destroyed because their own mistakes. It's the media, because we are breaking historical structure of power. That is very important. Well, according to answering what or referring to that published in the Washington Post, I don't know if you know that I live in the States 4 years, some of the happiest years in my life. I got 2 diplomas from the American University. So why should I be anti-Yankee? I don't understand.
I think it has to do with the case with Assange, Julian Assange. And
I should be anti-Yankee, so... Well, Obama is anti-Ecuador, because here in the States, for instance, there are 2 fugitives of the Ecuadorian justice, the Isaias brother. The American system, judiciary system, the government, etc., do not send them back to Ecuador. But at least 2 fugitives. There are much more.
Thank you, Mr. President, for your time.
No, thank you.
April 24th marks the first anniversary of the Rana Plaza disaster. More than 1,100 people were killed in the collapse of a building in Bangladesh housing garment factories, making clothes for some major international brands. That followed the 2012 Tazreen factory fire, also in Bangladesh, in which at least 112 workers died. If real change seems now to be afoot, it's not much thanks to corporate media, with some exceptions not especially to be relied on for stories in which corporate money-making clashes with human rights. Activists and so-called alternative media have been the ones pushing back against the obfuscations and denials, of the powerful players behind the scenes. Leila Al-Aryan is a writer and producer for Al Jazeera English in Washington, D.C., and author with Chris Hedges of Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Her new film, Made in Bangladesh, produced for Al Jazeera America's Fault Line series, recently won a Peabody Award. She joins us now in studio. Welcome back to Counterspin, Leila Al-Aryan.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
Well, one thing that I have noted is that coverage of workplace disasters like those in Bangladesh can be in some ways sympathetic. We're shown desperate conditions. We might see funerals, for example. But when you look for the corollary to sympathy for victims, which ought to be the interrogation of power, it seems like what you get is, well, Walmart, for example, would not speak to us for this segment, or empty official statements that sometimes get the last word in the story. It sounds like part of what you want to do with the film is ask questions about those corporate rationales, but how do you deal with that stonewalling?
That's a very good question. One of the challenges we faced making Made in Bangladesh is the fact that so many media outlets all over the world were already covering these disasters, from the Tazreen fire in November to the Rana Plaza collapse a few months later in April of 2013. And there was really an oversaturation of media coverage in some ways. So we needed to find a really unique angle, an exclusive investigative story to kind of move the story forward. We didn't want to just be one of many media outlets jumping on the story and doing sort of the checklist media coverage. So talking to victims and their family members, trying to seek a response from the corporations, and then more or less being stonewalled. And then, you know, just having sort of, in some ways, superficial media coverage. I think there is some utility from these kinds of stories, the more straight news stories. But I think for our purposes, we really wanted to look at the core problems. And what we did was we consulted with a lot of different people, from a former State Department official who specializes in these issues of workplace safety all over the world, to workers' rights advocates, etc. And they all said the same thing, which is you need to look at the supply chain, because that's where the problem lies. It's not just these individual disasters that you should look at. It's the entire structure is flawed. And you need to look at the fact that companies rely on the system of relying on subcontractors, where there really isn't accountability, where they pass the buck and they really shield themselves from responsibility in case disaster strikes. So that's what we did. We received internal Walmart documents related to a specific order that ended up in the Tazreen factory. And using these documents, we were able to construct their supply chain. This is very rare, because part of what these companies rely on is secrecy, and not having to really disclose the factories they use, the subcontractors they use. So we were really in a unique position to have every player in the supply chain revealed to us, from Walmart itself to its subcontractor, Success Apparel, based in New York City, to its agent, True Colors, based in Dhaka, Bangladesh, in India, and finally the factory that originally received the order, which had a very long relationship with Walmart that spanned 20 years. And we spent many days in this factory, spoke to the factory owner. And this was very revealing, because it really showed that there's a reason that Walmart relies on this system of subcontracting, and that it really is able to say it's our subcontractors who didn't follow the rules. We depend on them to uphold standards and to sort of throw their hands up in the air when these kinds of incidents happen.
Well, that's kind of my big question with regard to journalism. At what point do you stop buying that? Because, you know, you're saying you were able, with legwork, you know, to put together the supply chain. And yet Walmart often shuts down many a debate by simply saying, oh, we didn't know that supplier was making our clothes.
I think they have to continue asking the tough questions, which is, you know, who knew what when? What did Walmart know related in regards to the orders that end up in factories where disaster strikes? And why aren't they exercising more control if indeed they don't know? So either way, it doesn't really look good for the company. If you don't know, why don't you know? And if you do know and you're doing nothing about it, why is that? And it's important to note that there's really a power imbalance in these relationships. So these factories in Bangladesh really rely on companies like Walmart to keep them going, to sustain them. They rely on these large orders. So it's really up to the corporation to exercise responsibility.
That's another thing I think about media coverage. It's so often presented as a Bangladeshi problem or as a foreign problem when these are clothes that, you know, Americans are wearing. I mean, you can't really see it anymore as a problem over there versus over here because it is this network.
Absolutely. I mean, 80% of Bangladesh's exports are garments. So it's a really crucial part of the economy of Bangladesh. So, you know, the government in a way relies on this industry tremendously, and it's difficult to pin the blame solely on them when the companies really need to be at the forefront of change and consumers themselves really need to be at the forefront, because we have seen examples when countries have exercised more stringent restrictions and tried to ensure workplace safety, companies simply pull out of those countries and move elsewhere where labor is cheap and where they don't have to be hamstrung by these kinds of restrictions.
And briefly, was there something that you thought that documentary film could do that news media coverage per se could not or was not?
I think we have the advantage of time, so really being able to tell a story of a complicated supply chain in 25 minutes and just show the viewer how this system really works. And I think for that reason, just having that time to really flesh out a story was very good for us.
We've been speaking with Leila Al-Aryan, writer and producer for Al Jazeera English. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. You can get subscription information on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.